For the last two decades, the United States has been conducting an undeclared war across much of the globe, employing proxy forces from Africa to Asia, deploying commandos from the Philippines to the West African nation of Burkina Faso, and conducting airstrikes not only in Libya but in Afghanistan, Iraq, Pakistan, Somalia, Syria, and Yemen. Over those years, the U.S. military has taken pains to normalize the use of drone warfare outside established war zones while relying on allies around the world, as that Italian base in Syracuse, to help conduct its global war. "Clearly, a drone operation employing lethal force is not routine," said Meloni, legal advisor at European Center for Constitutional and Human Rights, adding, "While AFRICOM is directly responsible, the Italian commander must have known about and approved the operation and can therefore be criminally responsible as an accomplice for having allowed the unlawful lethal attack." That November 2018, drone attack in Libya was anything but a one-off strike. During just 6 months in 2011, alone, U.S. MQ-1 Predator drones flying from Signola conducted 241 airstrikes in Libya during Operation Unified Protector, the NATO air campaign against then-Libyan autocrat Muammar Gaddafi, according to retired Lieutenant Colonel Gary Peppers, the former commander of the 324th Expeditionary Reconnaissance Squadron. The unit was responsible, he told The Intercept in 2018, for over 20% of the total of all Hellfire missiles expended in 14 years of the system's employment. The U.S. air war in Libya accelerated in 2016 with Operation Odyssey Lightning. That summer, the Libyan government of National Accord requested American help in dislodging Daesh from Sirte. The Obama administration designated the city an area of active hostilities, loosening guidelines designed to prevent civilian casualties. Between August and December of that year, according to an African press release, the U.S. carried out, in Sirte alone, 495 precision airstrikes against vehicle-borne improvised explosive devices, heavy guns, tanks, command and control centers, and fighting positions. Those military strikes were nothing new. The United States has been conducting attacks in Libya since before there even was a Libya, and almost a United States. In his first address to Congress in 1801, President Thomas Jefferson spoke of coastal kingdoms in North Africa, including the least considerable of Barbary states, Tripoli, now the capital of modern Libya. His refusal to pay additional tribute to the rulers of those kingdoms in order to stop their state-sponsored privateers from seizing American sailors and cargo kicked off the Barbary Wars. In 1804, Lieutenant Stephen Decatur led a daring nighttime mission, boarding a captured U.S. ship, killing its Tripolitan defenders and destroying it. And an attack the next year by 9 Marines and a host of Allied mercenaries on the North African city of Derna ensured that the shores of Tripoli would have prime placement in the Marine Corps hive. A June 2021 Pentagon report on civilian casualties did acknowledge one of those incidents, the death of a civilian in Al-Baida, Yemen, on January 22, 2019. Matbana's investigation determined that the attack killed Saleh Ahmed Mohammed Al-Ghaisi, a 67-year-old farmer who locals said had no terrorist affiliations. The U.S. had previously acknowledged 4 to 12 civilian deaths in a raid by Navy SEALs on January 29, 2017, also chronicled by Matwana. Through it reported a high death toll. As for the remaining allegations, Central Command, which oversees U.S. military operations in the West Asia region, told Matwana in an April 2021 letter that it was confident that each airstrike hit its intended Al-Qaeda targets and nothing else. Rigorous investigative reporting by the New York Times on the last U.S. drone strike of the Afghan war in August 2021 forced an admission from the Pentagon. What General Mark Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, had originally deemed a righteous strike had actually killed 10 civilians, 7 of them children. A subsequent Times investigation revealed that the 2019 U.S. airstrike in Baghouz, Syria, had killed up to 64 non-combatants, a toll previously obscured through a multi-layered cover-up. The Times followed that up with an investigation of 1,300 reports of civilian casualties in Iraq and Syria, demonstrating, wrote reporter Azmat Khan, that the American air war in those countries was marked by deeply flawed intelligence, rushed and often imprecise targeting, and the deaths of thousands of civilians, many of them children, a sharp contrast to the American government's image of war waged by all-seeing drones and precision bombs. Since the Sirte campaign ended in late 2016, U.S. attacks in Libya have slowed considerably. AFRICOM conducted 7 declared airstrikes there in 2017, 6 in 2018, 4 in 2019, and none since. But the U.S. military has made little effort to re-evaluate past strikes and the civilian casualties they caused, including the November 2018 attack that killed Nasser Musa Abdullah. U.S. Africa Command followed the civilian casualty assessment process in place at the time and determined that the reports were unsubstantiated, said AFRICOM spokesperson Kelly Callan. Despite the criminal complaint filed on April 1st, the command is not re-examining the case. There is nothing new or different regarding the November 30, 2018 airstrike, Callan told reporters by email. Africa Command has clearly moved on, but Abdullah can't. Memories of his brother and those charred bodies are irrevocably lodged in his mind, but get caught in his throat. He says, I was in shock. He told reporters when discussing the phone call that preceded his dash across the desert. I'm so sorry, but I can't explain in words what I felt. Abdullah was similarly stuck when he attempted to describe the grisly scene that greeted him hours later. He was eloquent in speaking about the justice he seeks and how being branded a terrorist robbed his brother and their community of dignity. But of his final memory of Nasser, there is simply nothing that can be said. Not by him anyway. What I was seeing was so terrible. He told reporters, his voice rising, racked and loaded with pain, adding, I can't even describe it.
The Russell Tribunal on Palestine. By 1948, the Zionist Agency and Haganah had drawn up a plan to drive out the Arabs by using terror to spread fear and encourage civilians to leave their homes without any resistance. The Deir Yassin massacre, which left over 100 people dead, spread panic across Palestinian villages, as the Zionists had intended, and encouraged civilians to flee their homes. Ben-Gurion declared that old Palestinians would die and the young would forget their homeland. Gurion personally directed the obliteration of the Arab past with Judaized names of streets, villages and towns and building settlements on 350 destroyed Palestinian villages. But the Palestinian people have not forgotten their Palestine and dream of returning to their homes and land one day. The question that many Palestinians ask themselves today is, has the world forgotten about Palestine and its people? Events such as the Russell Tribunal on Palestine show that the world has not forgotten Palestine or the Palestinians. The first session on Palestine took place in 2010 and was established to examine the role and complicity of third parties, such as governments, institutions, and corporations in violation of international law committed by Israel against the Palestinian people. Since its creation in 1966, the Russell Tribunal has sought justice when powerful countries turned a blind eye. It demanded investigations when governments tried to hide. And now, the tribunal has reached its final session on Palestine.
We are back at Brussels as the jury looks back at the tribunal's work during the last 5 years. The jury is summarizing the findings of the previous sessions, from which it will draw general conclusions.
The tribunal's rulings are non-binding and have little more than sentimental value. I spoke to some of the participants at the tribunal and asked why they were taking part and what they felt was the purpose of these sessions.
Monitors the situation in the Middle East. We monitor violations of human rights law and international humanitarian law. We try to mobilize public opinion to make people more aware of the violations of international law by Israel, and we try to give the general public an opportunity to express their feelings and views on the subject of Palestine. I think we all agreed that the situation in Palestine is very serious, that Israel is guilty of serious violations of international law. But the problem is that the United States and the European states are largely unconcerned about the situation in Palestine. And so the purpose of the Russell Tribunal is really to create public awareness of the situation and to try to influence public opinion. And we also call upon the United Nations and states to comply with international law.
We are trying to address a message to the public opinions in Europe, in the United States, in Arab countries as well, and ask them to push to push on their governments where they are, to ask their governments to comply with the international law and to push Israel to comply with the international law and to sustain Palestinians to fulfill their rights, in particular the rights of self-determination, which is a right which is in the charter of the United Nations.
This tribunal concerns the most critical, unresolved situation of injustice on our planet. Sometimes it seems impossible of resolution, and yet I am very optimistic. Think of what has been achieved, the changes achieved in my lifetime, and indeed I think the lifetime of many in this room, too many perhaps. You know, we have to mobilize the young, as Stefan did with his books, also published in his 90s. We have seen the ending of apartheid. We have seen the ending of colonial rule in Africa. We have seen the fall of fascism in Latin America and indeed in many parts of Europe. We have seen the Berlin Wall pulled down. And these momentous changes happened because of the struggle and sacrifice of the peoples directly involved, aided by the solidarity of ordinary people and their organizations around the world. I am here because I am confident that the oppression of the Palestinian people will likewise be ended.
The tribunal has sought to galvanize international and public opinion in the hope that the international community would put pressure on Israel to cease its criminal activities and respect Palestinian sovereignty. Leila Shahid, the first Palestinian woman ambassador and the official representative of the Palestine Liberation Organization in Europe, shares her thoughts with me on the tribunal.
Of course, a tribunal of citizens. It's not an official one. But, you know, we are in the world of civil society. We have seen a revolution in Tunisia, in Egypt, in Bahrain, in Libya, in Yemen. The world is waking up. We have seen all the people who followed Stéphane Hessel and who made indignatos, you know, indignation in Wall Street, in Spain, in Portugal, in Greece, saying that the citizens also must have their own contribution to the implementation of civil rights, of human rights, and of international humanitarian law. So I think it has an impact, because now with the new media, television, internet, the whole world knows the truth. You know, 50 years ago, when they kicked out all the Palestinians, nobody knew what happened. Now people know the truth. And I think that's very important, that citizens in the world will also put pressure on their governments, on their elected member of parliament, to make Israel comply with its obligations in relation to the violation of the Palestinian people.
With the Arab Spring in full session, the Arab people are busy toppling their dictators and trying to bring democracy to their countries. Thus, for now, the plight of the Palestinian people is far from the forefront of their minds.
At the time of Barcelona session, we didn't have the Arab Spring. So the 100% of the Arabic countries were ruled by dictators, in fact. People have not been chosen by their people, you know. The leaders were self-designated leaders. And I think that they wanted to keep on their thrones. And to keep on their thrones, they have to obey to the people, the states, the countries, Europe, in the United States, etc. The leaders of the European Union and in the United States ensure them to be seated, to remain seated on their thrones. And they were afraid of their own people. So they didn't have, you know, an autonomy in the decision.
The problem is, of course, there is now a great problem between some of the Arab countries, particularly the Gulf countries, and Iran. Because you know that Iran is, and it's legitimate, is a power in this part of the world, like Turkey is, like Egypt is. It's normal. But the Gulf countries consider that the threat that they are facing first and foremost is from Iran. You know that there are problems between a number of Gulf countries, not only on the Persian or Arab Gulf, but also on the fact that in most of these countries there are important Shiite communities living in Bahrain, in Saudi Arabia, in Kuwait. So they have sort of put Palestine also as a second priority, not as a first priority. Then you have, of course, the Arab revolutions. You have in Egypt, in Tunisia, in Libya, a change, a very important change of government. So also they are thinking of their own internal situation, which is legitimate, so that they are not always available to support or to be very effective in their support of Palestine. They do, of course, at the UN, and this is how we were able to get 138 countries voting in favor, because also of Arab support. But I would say this period for the Arab world is a difficult one. This is why we cannot limit the solidarity to only the Arab countries. We must make it available for all the free people in the world. You saw in this jury, there are South Africans, you have British, you have American Indians, you have Argentinians, you have French, you have Dutch, you have people from all, you have Irish, you have people who are members of a jury who represent the world community of justice and law. And I think this is why they represent also a very important consciousness of the world. You know, in struggles in the world, unfortunately, very often, the governments, the regimes, make compromises because they have interest in oil, they have interest in making alliances with Israel. But when you talk to people who are people of thought, intellectual judges, jurists, then they are the conscious of the world. And I think that Stéphane Hessel, who was the honorary president of this tribunal, was the best example. But this also is an engine to make third parties in the world, citizens, parliaments, trade unions, churches, also enter the battle to force Israel to respect the Palestinian rights and to put an end to occupation and to accept the fact that the Palestinians have the right to a sovereign, independent state.
The Russell Tribunal has been more than just a simple gathering of citizens who are concerned for the Palestinian people. Far from just being an academic exercise, the tribunal has shed light on the suffering of the Palestinian people caused by the unjust criminal acts committed by Israel. But the plight of the Palestinian people remains the same, a daily struggle for survival under the rule of Israeli occupation. So how much has the tribunal actually achieved? I asked one of the main organizers of the tribunal, Frank Barrett, who has been fighting for justice for Palestine for the past decade, if the tribunal had achieved any of its goals.
I mean, we haven't achieved our goals because our goals are, you know, justice for Palestine, freedom for Palestine, and it's not, you know, it's not happened yet. But this is a long-term goal, obviously, and what we hope the tribunal will have permitted is to create an ever bigger momentum for those goals to be realized. So when we started in Barcelona talking about EU complicity, and when we moved to London about talking about corporations, and then the UN and the US, it was all about, again, empowering us, the people of Europe, North America, people that actually don't have maybe direct links to Israel, Palestine, but to empower us and to make us understand that actually we are all linked and to what's happening on the ground, regardless of our nationality or religious beliefs. And that the situation in Palestine touches us all. We can call it, if you want, the reproduction of the occupation is happening also in various countries around the world. And most importantly, we are not passive actors. We are very active actors because our governments are complicit, because the corporations we buy mobile phones from, shoes from, are also complicit. So it's down to us to stand up to those institutions, to our states and governments, and tell them that, you know, they're not talking in our name.
The tribunal may not have had the power to liberate Palestine and free the Palestinians from a life under occupation, but they have succeeded in putting pressure on international companies complicit in the atrocities committed by the Israeli state. And in so doing, the International Campaign Body for Freedom for Palestine has become larger and more powerful.
The London session, who was focusing on companies who are involved in the occupation, produced clear conclusions condemning these companies, amongst others Dexia, based on a legal analysis of human rights violations, etc., international law, which for us was very important. Secondly, it helped us to make Dexia stop the funding of these settlements. We didn't find any new loans anymore. And so this London session was very useful for that. And just I want to add one thing. The building where we are now for the closing session of the Russell Tribunal on Palestine used to be a building of the Dexia bank. And we were campaigning in the same room as we did now during the General Assembly. So it makes me very happy that this time, in the same building, it's not campaigning against this bank, but it's also a moment of a conclusion of a successful tribunal, which helped the solidarity movement on Palestine to make bigger networks and to make bigger pressure on companies, amongst others.
The London session of the tribunal was especially relevant to this theme of international solidarity. It was about the complicity of private corporations in Israel's violations of international law. We were hearing evidence about companies, some of them are familiar names, operating in our own countries and connected to Israel through a web of affiliates and subsidiaries. Private corporations are deeply involved in the three main areas in which international law has been violated: the building of the settlements in Jerusalem and the West Bank, the construction of the separation wall on the West Bank on Palestinian territory, and the incursion of Israeli forces into Gaza in the Operation Cast Lead, inflicting horrendous damage in December 2008 into January 2009. By way of example, and these are just examples, the British-Danish giant G4S to its Israeli subsidiary, G4S Israel, is responsible for the security operations in the military checkpoints at the wall, in the settlements, and in the prisons. The very symbols of oppression are being organized by this British-Danish company. The United States company Caterpillar has supplied the Israeli army with the bulldozers which have demolished Palestinian houses and cleared land for the construction of the wall. The French transport company Veolia built and operated the light rail project in occupied Jerusalem. Significantly, the tribunal wrote to all these companies, and Veolia replied, informing us that it had decided to divest its interest in that project.
The tribunal was about empowering us and make us realize that what's happening in Palestine and Israel is not a faraway conflict, but we are all active actors and we should stand up against, you know, any injustice in the world, in particular in Palestine.
We're entering a new phase at the end of the hearings, the formal hearings. A new phase, and I'm going to, in a sense, declare it as a legal intifada. A legal intifada in which all of you and all of us, whether we're in a formalized body or not, utilize the tools, utilize the international frameworks that are there to bring about change and make a difference, which we know we can do. I'll illustrate how this is in that very short time frame you see up there, really, 2010 to now, barely three years. What has happened in one or two ways? And the intifada that I'm talking about is, therefore, that Israel is going to be faced with challenges, legal challenges, on all fronts, at all times, from all sides. And those who are imprisoned in Palestine should know that we're out there to support them, to support the rule of law.
The U.S. and the U.N. Continue to support Israel as it commits the most awful crimes against humanity. And, of course, the Russell Tribunal, in its strategies for the future, focuses a great deal on the need to utilize the U.N., particularly given the fact that despite presence of Israel and the U.S., the General Assembly recently accorded Palestine non-member observer state status, which means that Palestine is now in a position, and we support the Palestinians who are calling for this, to join the International Criminal Court, and it can demand standing to bring charges against Israel.
Frank Barrett further explains what conclusion the jury had reached.
As the jury just said, the tribunal in itself, in terms of having sessions every year, is over. We feel we have addressed, you know, the topics we wanted to address. The complicities of various third parties have been thoroughly addressed. We've established that legally we could call Israel an apartheid state. So for us, this is now a time for, we've got the basis, we've got the law on our side, how to implement it, how to make sure people around the world make the findings of the tribunal their finding, then, you know, talk to their governments about it, talk to their families about it, talk to their bosses about it. And the next few months, there's going to be a lot of work in terms of follow-up, going to various countries, going to various solidarity groups, having meetings with them, a brainstorm with them, to try to see how we, as an internationalist movement, if you know what I mean, can make sure justice in Palestine is happened.
We had witness, we had the legal context provided, explaining the Palestinian right to self-determination, nature of this denial by Israel, its relation to apartheid and persecution, the prohibition of apartheid in international law, the law and practice of apartheid in South Africa, as well as an overview of Israeli law and policy with respect to the prohibition of apartheid. These experts defined apartheid relating to the status of racial groups under international law, Palestinian identity and the notion of racial domination, the notion of apartheid as an institutional regime of systematic domination, such as Israel's treatment of the Palestinians.
Of course, we who live in the United States have a very special responsibility to bring pressure on the U.S. government, including President Obama, incorporation of the progressive desires of the planet. And of course, it was important that we were able to elect him president and re-elect him. But now is the time to pressure him to cease his support of Israel and the awful crimes against humanity that it continues to commit.
United States must accept responsibility for the continued expansion of settlements and for allowing Israel to build a colonial empire and to practice apartheid in the occupied Palestinian territory. This was the one thing Israel did not want. This is the one thing that's now in place. And if you, the Palestinian Authority, do not use the opportunity to go to the court and essentially put Israel on trial for all those things that are mapped out in our various documents, then it is a betrayal. And so therefore we say in no uncertain terms, here we go, Intifada, legal. Thank you.
There you have it. This is the end of the tribunal, but certainly not the end of the struggle, the fight, the campaigning, or the solidarity. In its closing session, the tribunal encouraged people to visit Palestine to witness the daily lives of the Palestinians and agreed a future plan forward, a future that includes an independent, sovereign Palestinian state, free from the shackles of Israeli occupation, and with the Palestinian refugees back in the homes they fled 65 years ago.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
In the limelight. In the United States, top leaders of the far-right extremist group, the Proud Boys, including its national chairman, Enrique Tarrio, have been charged with seditious conspiracy for plotting to storm the U.S. Capitol to obstruct the certification of Joe Biden's election win over Donald Trump on 6th of January 2021. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalist Hugo Lowell. The piece is titled, Proud Boy Leaders Charged with Seditious Conspiracy in 6th of January Riot. In the United States, top leaders of the far-right militia group, The Proud Boys, including its national chairman, Enrique Tarrio, have been charged with seditious conspiracy for plotting to storm the U.S. Capitol to obstruct the certification of Joe Biden's election win over Donald Trump on 6th of January 2021. The move by federal prosecutors to charge Enrique Tarrio and four other Proud Boys leaders with seditious conspiracy, in addition to previous charges of obstructing a congressional proceeding, marks a major development in the criminal investigation into the Capitol attack. In their 33-page indictment, unsealed in Washington, D.C. on Monday, the Justice Department said Enrique Tarrio and his co-defendants, Joseph Biggs, Ethan Nordine, and Zachary Rell, and Dominic Pezzola, for months used encrypted messaging apps to stop Joe Biden's certification by force. The new charges against the Proud Boys' leadership comes just days before the parallel congressional inquiry into the Capitol attack is scheduled to start televised hearings that are expected to examine, in part, Donald Trump's personal culpability in the events of 6th of January 2021. Seditious conspiracy, which is challenging to prove, requires federal prosecutors to show beyond a reasonable doubt that at least two people agreed to use force to overthrow the government or to interfere with the execution of a United States law. The new indictment is the latest involving seditious conspiracy after the Justice Department filed identical charges earlier this year against top members of the far-right militia group the Oath Keepers, including its founder Stuart Rhodes, over the Capitol attack. A bipartisan U.S. Senate report linked seven deaths to the Capitol attack, which failed to stop certification of Joe Biden's election win. Donald Trump was impeached for inciting an insurrection, but acquitted when enough Senate Republicans stayed loyal to him. In addition, under seditious conspiracy charges, the Justice Department appeared to indicate that it has learned new information in recent weeks about the Proud Boys' plans ahead of 6th of January 2021 as a result of several significant developments. One of the Proud Boys, who was originally charged with Enrique Tarrio and the other co-defendants for obstructing a congressional proceeding, Charles Donahue, pleaded guilty in April and accepted a plea deal to cooperate with the criminal investigation into the militia group. Meanwhile, though the indictment also identified unindicted co-conspirators, Person 1 is understood to be Jeremy Bertino, and Person 2 is likely to be Aaron Wallen Walkind. Neither of those men have been charged. A third top Proud Boys leader, John Stewart, also remains uncharged. The U.S. government said in the indictment that on 20th of December 2020, Enrique Tarrio created a chat called MOSD Leaders Group, described by Tarrio as a national rally planning committee that included Nordine, Biggs, Rell, and other individuals who were not identified. Through the rest of December, the government said Proud Boys leaders used additional MOSD group chats to plan a trip to Washington, D.C. and communicate to group members that they should go to the Capitol not wearing their familiar black and yellow colors, but travel incognito instead. The government said in the indictment that on 30th and 31st of December 2020, Enrique Tarrio communicated with an individual whose identity is known only to a grand jury, who sent him a 9-page document called 1776 Returns, in reference to the year of the American independence from Britain. It laid out a plan to occupy crucial buildings on 6th of January 2021. The document broadly outlined a plan to reconnoiter and storm crucial government buildings in Washington, D.C. on 6th of January, though not the Capitol building itself, the New York Times reported earlier. Enrique Tarrio is said to have received the 1776 returns document from one of his girlfriends, who compared the plan to storming the Winter Palace in St. Petersburg, Russia, that sparked the Russian Revolution in 1917, the New York Times reported. The indictment cited a reference to the moment in the new indictment, drawing upon what appeared to be newly uncovered text messages. After the Capitol attack ended, Bertino messaged Enrique Tarrio, 1776, to which Tarrio responded, "The Winter Palace." 3 days before the Capitol attack, a Proud Boy, referred to only as Person 3, posted a voice message in the MOSD leaders group that stated the main operating theater should be out in front of the House of Representatives, according to the indictment. That's where the vote is taking place with all of the objections, the Person Number 3 said, according to the indictment. Planned operations based around the front entrance to the Capitol building. I strongly recommend you use the National Mall and not Pennsylvania Avenue. The new pieces of evidence in the latest indictment were messages that Bertino sent to Enrique Tarrio after the attack. "You know we made this happen," Bertino said, referring to the implications of obstructing Joe Biden's win. Bertino added, "They have to certify today, or it's invalid." Enrique Tarrio was not in Washington, D.C., however, on 6th of January 2021, having been ordered to leave the Capitol by a judge after being arrested the day before for burning a Black Lives Matter banner at a church during a pro-Donald Trump rally in December. But the Justice Department has said that even though Enrique Tarrio was not accused of physically taking part in the breach of the Capitol building, he led the advance planning and remained in contact with other members of the Proud Boys militia during the attack. 11 members of the Oath Keepers militia are also charged with seditious conspiracy. Lawyers for Enrique Tarrio and other 4 Proud Boys leaders have said there is no evidence they conspired to storm the Capitol building, and that the MOSD group chats and the acquisitions of tactical gear before 6th of January were measures to protect themselves in case of potential altercations.
Bazaar.
Health is a crucial social and economic asset. It is seen as a cornerstone for human development and the expansion of any economy. It is also considered a fundamental human right. The medical device industry is a sector with the sole purpose of improving the quality of life of its customers. Moreover, it's a source of medical innovation with heavy regulations. As a result, a lot happens behind the scenes before medical devices are released into the market.
Well, hello there, and welcome to another edition of Bazaar. This time, we will venture through Iran's medical sector while shining the spotlight on medical device production. We wanted to understand how this sector has grown over the years and uncover who the major players are in this field. Plus, we will look at this sector's contribution to society and the economy. So, let's get to it. The capital city, Tehran, has been buzzing with multiple industry exhibits in recent weeks. One of the most anticipated exhibits is the Medical Laboratory Device Show, which drew a lot of participants this year. We visited the expo to see how this market is faring and check out some of the latest developments. We caught up with several companies holding pavilions at the exhibit. Virajin was one of them. It specializes in making machines and equipment used in labs for research and diagnosis. Many holding companies were also present at the show, along with their subsidiaries, who presented their products. But that's not all. The exhibit also provides a platform for getting to know what types of services these holding companies offer.
I should say that we are a holding company, including four different companies. The holding company name is Vista Padina, and the subsidiaries companies are Tubanegi, which is active in fields of molecular biology and life sciences for more than 25 years, and Arya Tashkis Pars, which is active in fields of the tubes for the blood collection from very well-known companies for more than 20 years, and they are one of the main suppliers of the tubes for the laboratories to collect the bloods for the tests. One of our companies is just for engineering and giving backups, after-sales service and backup for the instruments. And the other company is Sima Polymer, which they have the production line for the plastic wares of the for the laboratories in different applications.
Thousands and thousands of products were on display here, which are mainly used in medical laboratories. Some companies displayed consumable items used in labs like swabs or thinning liquids. Others produced diagnostic kits. It might be interesting to know that medical diagnostic kits used to be previously imported. However, now with the efforts of research-based firms, many of these items have been indigenized. We spoke with a company that not only has saved the country millions on imports, but also supports various knowledge-based startups. Exhibits like this one are bustling with people. It's a place where downstream and upstream companies in the medical lab sector can gather and showcase their latest. It also is an excellent place for potential investors to scout out lucrative investment opportunities and check out the local competition. So scores of companies participated in this exhibit this year. Among these companies were knowledge-based manufacturers, startups, raw material suppliers, and much more. Visitors are given a chance to evaluate and discover the latest innovative products and solutions in the lab sector across all ranges. The exhibit has been put on hold since 2019 due to the coronavirus outbreak. Now it is in full swing again. Medical Laboratory Device Exhibit took place in Iran Mall. It is one of the biggest shopping centers in Iran that also offers an expansive space for trade shows. The coronavirus outbreak is subsiding nationwide due to the extensive vaccination campaign. And now, many businesses are enjoying in-person interactions through this exhibition once again. The goal of the Medical Lab Device Show is to further develop services and products used in clinical labs. It's a place where domestic and foreign participants can interact and strengthen networks.
It also gathers medical industry participants, such as doctors and hospital owners, among many others in the healthcare trade. In addition, the Expo is a platform where industry decision makers visit and where scores of business deals are closed. The exhibition was coupled with a medical lab science and device conference. It was the 13th round of the international conference that was jointly held by the Medical Council and the Association of Clinical Laboratory Doctors. This was a significant event in the field of lab sciences aiming to improve lab services and technology. Some 2,700 participants from various fields of lab sciences joined the event, either virtually or in person. The five-day conference included 25 specialized seminar panel meetings with international guest speakers among Iranian experts in the field. The purpose of the conference is to exchange scientific knowledge and bridge a dialogue between lab sciences and clinical disciplines. It was also a platform to check out the latest global tech that are being used to improve lab services. Many hot topics were discussed during the conference, such as lessons learned from the coronavirus outbreak. Other discussions revolved around the future of medical diagnostic labs and the technology that will shape them. Industry practitioners say medical lab sciences is one of the most overlooked sectors in the industry, yet it plays a crucial role in the medical sector. Some 70% of all diseases in society are diagnosed by the laboratory community. All disciplines of laboratory sciences, inducing lab specialists, pathologists, and clinicians, were at the forefront of the battle with the coronavirus. These specialists worked tirelessly around the clock to create diagnostic kits, treatments, and equipment needed to combat the disease. Iran has taken giant strides in the health and medical sector over the past two decades. In fact, Iran's medical device market is growing faster than the world average. The country is globally ranked fourth for engineering over 1,000 medical devices to show for it too. Plus, this technological capacity has allowed the country to churn out advanced devices in the medical sector. Out of the 1,000 active medical device manufacturers, nearly 230 of them are knowledge-based firms. These companies generate some 30% of revenues in the domestic medical device market. That's all based on figures from the Vice Presidential Office for Science and Technology. Going off of data from Iran's Medical Equipment Office of the Ministry of Health, over 2,000 different types of medical devices are domestically produced. All of these meet EU standardization requirements for sales. Also, statistics showed over half of the 500,000 medical devices made globally have Iranian versions, reducing imports by 10%. Iran also exports these items to over 50 countries worldwide, including Russia, Germany, and Italy, among others. The National Medical Device Directorate reported that back in 2018, this market was worth nearly $3 billion. The latest figures have not been made public yet, and this amount is likely much higher this year. The surge in production in this sector is attributed to the hard work of knowledge-based firms and research institutions. Gas powers production, and oil greases the gears of the industry. Without gas and oil, most industries probably wouldn't thrive as they are today. The world consumes around 36 billion barrels of oil per year. Oil and gas are major industries in the energy market and play a significant role in the global economy as the world's primary fuel source. Meanwhile, the process and systems involved in producing and distributing oil and gas are highly complex. They require lots of money and state-of-the-art technology. Today, we'll venture through Iran's oil and gas industry. This sector is massive, and its enormity doesn't quite sink in until you visit one of the industry's annual exhibits. So, we visited the country's 26th International Oil, Gas, Refining and Petrochemical Exhibition, dubbed the Iran Oil and Gas Show.
We'll explore this sector's development and uncover why it's essential to the national economy.
The Oil and Gas Show is one of the largest exhibitions in the global oil industry. It takes place every year and serves as a place for domestic and foreign industry participants to interact. The exhibition is based on the theme of knowledge-based oil, Iranian production, and global exports. It is based on this year's economic goal set by Iran's leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. The leader has emphasized strengthening the knowledge-based economy by adopting a scientific and technical approach in all fields. The exhibition showcases the latest products made by Iranian knowledge-based firms. It's a platform for expanding business markets and finding potential customers and suppliers, among other things. We caught up with a few participants to see what types of products and services they offered in this sector. This company manages an entire oil field in southern Iran. Moreover, it engineers machines and compressors needed for refining and processing crude oil and gas products.
Petro Iran Development Company, Petco, is one of the subsidiaries of NIOC, and we are acting as an E&P and GC contractor, and we are involved in several upstream and downstream projects, mainly in Iran and even abroad. The 26th Oil and Gas Show was one of the biggest show during the past even 10 years. As I noticed during these 3 days, there were very good participation of foreign companies. And these foreign companies, it was my surprise that they are not seeking for individual work by themselves. They are looking for cooperative work. Joint ventures with Iranian companies, and because we have a very good, capable Iranian manufacturers and contractors, and I have seen lots of agreements that have been signed during these 3 days. There are very big opportunities for investment in Iran because of nowadays situation in the world. There are a very massive request, demand for Iranian oil and Iranian industry. Manufacturers and contractors, and as it was noticed in this fair, more than 8 billion euros of investment agreement was signed, and I think that it we have this opportunity to up to 20 billion euros of investment to sign with the Iranian and even foreign countries.
Another pavilion displayed the cutting-edge technology used in downstream and upstream oil industries. This company is also developing various oil fields and supplying electrical power.
Each year, scores of people and industry participants visit and hold pavilions in this exhibit. Such events also provide unique access to leading decision makers in the oil and gas industry. Additionally, it is a place for knowledge exchange and determining current needs and future development vectors. This year, the fair opened with 1,200 Iranian and 44 foreign exhibitors from 11 countries.
Another benefit of the fair is networking and creating new business opportunities throughout the energy sector with prospective business agreements. A significant number of business deals were closed during the 3-day oil and gas show. There is a lot of potential for investment in the oil and gas industry. This exhibit provides chances to link investors with potential joint ventures in this field. It's noteworthy that 23 universities and research centers and over 100 knowledge-based companies, startups, and technology parks participated in this event. High-profile representatives of foreign companies from 22 countries were present at the show too. The most notable was the Secretary General of the Gas Exporting Countries Forum, Mohammad Hamal. Other important figures included the Minister of Oil, Javad Oji, Parliament Speaker, Mohammad Bagher Ghalibaf, and the Head of Parliament's Energy Committee, Feridun Hassanvand. The sprawling fairgrounds were packed with all sorts of equipment and machinery used in the oil and gas industry. These ranged from advanced technology for extracting